Good morning, and welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm really pleased to be here this morning with you, and especially to once again be able to give voice to the issues related to the ADAP program and to issue this report. As you will soon hear, the ADAP picture over the past year has been a little different than in the past, and we want to share that with you, although some of the news coming out more immediately from the field may not be as rosy as the report. We also always want to do this program because we want to highlight the people who depend on the ADAP program, the vulnerable population that uses the program, what it means to them to receive these services. The ADAP safety net was initially started as an emergency measure to help states pay for AIDS medications, but it has really become part of the fabric of the way this nation deals with the AIDS epidemic. And I think it has become a real mainstay of the HIV care system in the U.S. Finally, this year, we also want to paint a more in-depth picture of the state fiscal environment and specifically the potential impact of the economic downturn the country is now experiencing on the ADAPs and on the clients that they serve. I think it's also a time to take stock of the implementation of the Medicare drug benefit and the impact that has had on the availability of prescription drug medication for those who now qualify through the Medicare program as well. I'm very pleased to be able to turn the podium over in a few minutes to Julie Schofield at NASDED, but I really want to once again thank the many people here who work on this program. One of our longest standing projects, we launched it in 1996, and Julie Schofield, NASDED's Executive Director, has of course been a part of this since the beginning. Murray Penner, NASDED's Deputy Executive Director for Domestic Programs, and their whole team, and especially to my team here at Kaiser, to Alicia Carbaugh and Jennifer Cates, who keep this program much in our perspective as we continue our policy work at Kaiser. I also want to thank HRSA and Doug Morgan for being part of this event, and to Ron Schnell at NCSL, who is here to offer us a very important perspective on what's going on at the state level with ADAPs. And especially a very big thanks to the state ADAP coordinators and directors who are on the front lines day in and day out. And we try to give them a national voice through this report, but it is they who carry out the work and who give us the information on which we base this report. So thank you for your cooperation. Now I'm going to be very pleased to be able to turn the program and podium over to Julie Schofield at NASDED. Julie was NASDED's first executive director, starting at the helm of that organization in 1993, and of course being a major impetus behind getting this project started. As the executive director still, she probably knows more about the wide range of issues, challenges, and changes facing ADAPs over their history, and no one is better positioned to lead that effort. I think it's kind of a coincidence that I joined the foundation in 1993, so 1993 was a really good year, I think, for health policy leadership in this country. So now I will turn it over to Julie, and thank you all for being here, and Julie, for your tremendous work.
Good morning, everyone. It does seem like just yesterday, actually, that I was standing here having the opportunity to say hello and greet you all for the release of last year's report. And it's wonderful to be here again with Kaiser. I can't believe the years have gone by as quickly as they have. And this year in particular, I've been starting out all my talks with a reference that's very personal to me, and that is by asking a question of folks in the audience. My staff know the answer, don't answer, but it is, what do Michael Jackson, Madonna, Prince, Alec Baldwin, Jamie Lee Curtis, Kevin Cranston, the AIDS director of Massachusetts, Kevin O'Connor from CDC, my twin sister, and me all have in common this year? Somebody's got to know the answer. We're all turning 50. So I think, you know, what a fabulous cohort to be among when you think about how time flies. And so I've had to reflect on that a lot this year, actually, and have decided, because of the cohort of folks that are turning 50 this year, that we get to celebrate all year long and reflect on our 50 years on this planet. I also, when I think about the time that goes by and the last year, want to do a couple of very personal remembrances, because there are a couple of folks who aren't with us this year who have been a part of this project in the past. And so in particular, I just want to take a moment to remember Steve Sherman. As many of you know, Steve Sherman was the ADAPT director for the state of North Carolina for many, many years, and in fact sat on this panel, I think more than once, to talk about the trials and tribulations that North Carolina has had through the years in keeping their ADAPT program afloat and making sure it could serve as many people as possible. And Steve was also a founding member of NASDAQ's ADAPT Crisis Task Force, and some of you may know he passed away quite suddenly just a couple of weeks ago. And so I want to sort of commit today's presentation to the memory of Steve Sherman and all of the work that he did through the years, and want us all to just remember him as we're doing this work today and for the next several weeks. I also, in the last year, lost a friend who had been living with HIV for about 20 years, and he was from the state of West Virginia. And we've also had West Virginia here at our table and at our panel. And my friend Kurt Hinton was also a member of my cohort. He would have been turning 50 this year. And he died right over the holidays. And what has been really poignant for me in remembering Kent is that he really died of complications of his hepatitis infection on top of his HIV infection. And so I think that helps me remember that despite the fact that we've made so much progress in treatment, this disease is still with us, it still has complications, and we still have a lot of work to do together to make sure that we can assure that folks living with HIV and their various comorbidities are getting all the services they need and all the kinds of treatment they need. So I also want to just take a moment here today to remember my friend Kent Hinton, because again, it's remembering these folks, I think, as we do this work year after year after year, that help give us inspiration and keep us moving forward. Of course, I have to thank Kaiser Family Foundation for this long-term partnership. It is our longest-standing partnership with NASDAQ, and we're very proud of this work that we do together every year. Jen, it's fabulous to be working with you, and I really appreciate the fact that we've extended our partnership beyond looking at ADAPT programs. We have launched this year a prevention program inventory, and hopefully one day in the next year you'll also be hearing a report on what the findings of that assessment have been, where we're really trying to be able to describe in some detail what prevention programs look like across the country. So that's a to-be-announced forthcoming, I think, findings. I also want to acknowledge my staff who've been working so hard on this report. I mean, you can always tell when we're in the middle of ADAPT monitoring report because there are some people that are a little on edge from time to time and putting in an awful lot of hours to make sure that we get it right. And I really want to acknowledge the lead authors for NASDAQ this year, Britton Ginsburg and Beth Kritzinger-Perry. Thank you so much, and I want to give you a round of applause. I also want to tell Beth. Beth's partner is on the verge of giving birth to their second daughter, and it's okay now, Beth. You've made it to the event. You tell Laura anytime, just go for it. Have that baby, because you can go now that we've got this report concluded. I also want to thank all our industry partners who've been so supportive of this work and our federal partners, and I want to say a very special thank you to Doug Morgan. Doug has had a year. I don't even know how to describe the year that Doug has had. But I have to say, you know, we are grateful for the partnership. We're really happy that he's able to join us today. And I want to publicly, you know, plead with him to please stay at HRSA, because if Doug were to ever leave, we would be in very big trouble. Well, I know that after we've all been here for how many years, you know, every once in a while we think of things like, you know, retirement and other things like that. But I have to say that, you know, Doug is really unique in the sense that he works with each and every jurisdiction individually to try to make it work for them. I mean, he does customized personal technical assistance for Part A and B grantees across the country. And if we were to lose that institutional knowledge and experience, I think we'd be in big trouble. So, Doug, thank you for being here, and thank you for all the work you've done over the last year trying to make sense of the reauthorized Ryan White program. And I'm going to give you a round of applause. You know, this project began many years ago because we really did think it was important to monitor AIDS drug assistance programs year to year to really see what was happening out there because of the uniqueness of ADAPS. You know, it's not an entitlement program. We rely on annual appropriations, and that means it is very challenging and tricky for jurisdictions to be able to predict how they could mold this program to serve the most clients with the most available treatments. And we continue to see year after year after year new challenges in assuring that we can make the most out of this program. I think what you'll see this year in the report is that ADAPS are doing slightly better than they've done in the past. They are a little bit more solvent. We have found that ADAP programs have been able in the last year to serve more clients and to add more treatments. And I think we can really begin to talk about some of the impact of the reauthorized Ryan White program, some of the changes that were made to that program in terms of its structure, in terms of the formulas, and in terms of the fact that some new resources were pumped into the program that through these various changes were also delivered to jurisdictions, enabling them to really continue to support their programs. The other thing, though, that I think you'll start to hear this year through this year's report is the incredible linkage between the Part B base and the CARE programs and ADAP programs. And what we're starting to hear for the first time is that there's a real need for increased funding for the base, for the CARE programs that are essential to be able to get people into care and keep them into care and keep them accessing the treatment. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit today, but we have heard from some jurisdictions that say we can't keep expanding our ADAP program unless we can ensure that CARE is going to be there along with it. So we have to make sure that we can, you know, raise the tide so that both boats float. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about the impact of the Ryan White program and I think and the reauthorization on the program. But I also think what we'll hear today is that Medicare Part D has also continued to support the expansion of ADAP programs. And that it's been a struggle from jurisdictions to see how that all fits together, but we are learning more about that impact. So on that note, I want to really get our panel started and turn it over to Jen Cates. I want to thank Jen again for her incredible partnership on this program, certainly on our prevention program, and also for the voice of science and policy that you bring to the national AIDS community. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen experiences where, you know, folks haven't always had the best information or been able to interpret data, and Jen's always there out in the community with a voice that says, let me help explain, you know, what you're reading. Let me help give you the science base that can help inform our programs. And I really appreciate that about Jen and want to welcome her to the podium now.
Thank you, Julie. And I will echo everyone's welcome to everyone here. Thank you for joining us once again. And both Diane and Julie have done a lot of my introductions and welcomes and thanks. I'm just going to be very brief on that so that we can get to the findings for this year and our discussion, because for me, the most fulfilling part of this is the discussion that we have here. This project is not just an important one to Kaiser, but to me personally, it's one that I spend a lot of energy and time on, care a lot about, and to see it all come together like this and really provide information and themes and messages is critical. Very quickly, and just extending my thanks to NASDAQ and to states, because it really is one of my best opportunities to work with all the states on these incredible programs, just to our teams, Alicia, Beth, and Britton. They really are the main authors this year, and that's a big, important thing for both Murray and myself. It gives us a little bit more time to do other things, but also it was great to watch them really take this on and understand everything about putting such a project together. So if you have any questions, ask them, because they could probably answer better than we can. And again, thanks to HRSA, NCSL, and to our state representatives. I will briefly introduce everyone before I present the findings so that we can just try to flow from there. Full bios are in your packets. Obviously, you've heard about Murray. Murray's been the main force behind this project and most and all of the domestic programs at NASDAQ for years and years, and has prior experience working at the state and local level. So really is the perfect person to have bringing it all together and helping us understand not just what one state is experiencing or two, but really the whole picture. Doug, you've already heard about Doug. I agree, Doug, please stay at HRSA. So that's, I'll just add that. And our two state representatives today, we have Christine Olson from South Dakota, who oversees Rhine-White Part B, ADAP, HIV surveillance, and probably several other HIV programs that we'll hear about. And we also have Noreen O'Donnell from South Carolina, who also oversees Rhine-White Part B, ADAP, the insurance program, HOPWA, and probably other things. And I think that alone just tells you that while we are spending a lot of energy focusing on what's going to states and how that reaches clients, we also have to remember that there's very few people that are able to coordinate all of this at the state level. These are small programs, and the people do a yeoman's job of making them work. We're also very pleased to have Ron Snell here from NCSL. It was important to us as we looked at the findings and we're hearing reports about the economic downturn to better understand what the state fiscal environment beyond ADAPS really meant. And I think for all of us who work in HIV, we're very focused on our world, but there's a bigger state environment that we also need to understand. So Ron will be here to share that with us. So now I will present the first part of the findings and then Murray the second, and then we'll discuss. So you already heard about the history of this project. It certainly was one that I was able to start on right away when I started here over a decade ago. And hopefully everyone who's been following it has seen it evolve. What we do each year is we survey all of the ADAPs, and we have a very good response at this point. We survey all ADAPs that are eligible for federal ADAP earmark funding, which was 58 in 2007, and 53 responded. The non-responders are a very small share of the population of people living or reported with HIV and AIDS cases, and those are mostly territories and associated jurisdictions. We wish we had all 58, but we feel pretty good about the group that we do get. The data that we'll show you are from two different pictures. One is a monthly snapshot, and we do that to try to help us better understand trends over time. So we have June 2007 data for many indicators, and we also have fiscal year 2007 data for the budget side. And then finally, there are a few areas like waiting lists and other things that we do more regular follow-up on so we can provide up-to-the-minute information. And in fact, we got an email yesterday from the one state that has a waiting list talking about their waiting list having just increased. So I think it really gives you a sense of what we're trying to convey today, which is that good news has to be tempered and understood in a larger context. All of the materials from today are on our website, and all of the data that we'll show you and that's in the report is on State Health Facts. It's downloadable. You can use it, and please do. So a few of the highlights and major themes putting the picture together. We've always made this point, we cannot make it enough, that ADAPs are the nation's prescription drug safety net for people with HIV, many people who would fall through the cracks without them. And the other thing we want to always mention is that they reach the target. The target for ADAPs and the target that I think Congress wanted to reach was people who would have no other way to get medications, people who are low income, people who are sick or could become sicker. And we see that when we look and don't have any insurance or are underinsured. When we look at the profile of clients, that is who this program is reaching. So it's reaching its target. The caseload over time continues to grow in general. For a variety of reasons. The population of people in need is growing. There's more people living with HIV in the U.S. There's been additional funding. States are getting more nuanced and sophisticated about these programs, so the caseload is growing. And the clients that ADAP is serving, not just reflective of the target of this program, but reflect the national epidemic in general. They're concentrated in the states with the highest numbers of people living with HIV and AIDS. If you look at the South, which has the greatest number of people living with HIV and AIDS, it also has the greatest share of the caseload relative to any other region. And there's other, we have in the report some more detail on the caseload across the country, and you can see it reflecting the national epidemic. More themes. We also, as Julie mentioned, are seeing the effects of Ryan White reauthorization. 2 years ago at the release, we all sat here and said, what's going to happen with reauthorization when it happens? Then it happened. So last year we said, we don't know yet what this is going to mean. And now we're actually starting to see it. It's still in progress, but we are starting to see the impact of this. And there's been some good impacts. For example, the ADAP supplemental, which we'll hear more about. It's sometimes hard to understand what that is. We hear it all the time. But understanding its role is very critical. And one of the states here, actually, South Carolina, has benefited from that and will share that experience with us. So, and also the minimum formulary requirement that we all heard about and didn't quite know what that would mean. And we'll be able to report a little bit on that. So all in all, we saw some good news when we looked at the data, that there seemed to be a collection of factors that eased some of the pressures we were seeing. If you look at the waiting list trends, we track them pretty regularly with NASDAQ. In September, for the first time ever since we've been tracking waiting lists, there was a brief period where not a single state had a waiting list in the country. Very soon after that, one state instituted a waiting list again with very few people, but we always try to remember that one person on a waiting list is one person on a waiting list who's maybe not getting medications. We also heard from that same state, Montana, that their waiting list increased to several people, and they're concerned that that might continue to happen. So it shows you that some of these, the positive story can be tempered. Many states increased enrollment, and formularies expanded. And there's lots of reasons for this. We'll talk about them. The report mentions them. We also just want to say that with the good news, there's some concern about the future. Some of the things that led to the good news are uncertain, not predictable. We're hearing things about the state economic downturn, and we don't know what that's going to mean for ADAPs. And one of the findings that we see each year, and it's very, very poignant, is that ADAPs are really having to deal with budget levers or the parts of the ADAP budget. There's many components of the ADAP budget, really work as levers. One thing may go up, that may influence other things. Something doesn't go up, other things may kick in. But there's very few of those are stable and predictable. They tend to be reactive. And so from a planning perspective, it's a little bit of a challenge for states, I think. Some of the changes in reauthorization, I mentioned the minimum formulary requirement, which really meant at least one this is how HRSA interpreted the policy, at least one antiretroviral from each approved ARV drug class. That's the minimum formulary requirement. And you'll see that all states met that as they were required to and actually went beyond that to some extent. The ADAP supplemental, which is a portion of the federal ADAP earmark that Congress earmarks for ADAPs each year, that percentage that was 3% of that earmark increased in the reauthorization to 5%, and that made a difference. Another thing that changed was a matching requirement for the ADAP supplemental, which we had heard in the past some states having to match that was a barrier for them in applying or even going through it with getting the funding. And that has potentially changed. There's changes in other parts of this as well. The funding formula, this was a big topic of discussion, moving from just looking at estimated living AIDS cases to estimated living HIV cases and AIDS cases, and we'll probably get into that a little bit. And there were changes to other parts of Ryan White, and as Julie mentioned, understanding ADAP in the context, not just of what's happening with that program each year, but the other parts of Ryan White that together make up a care system is critical. So some data on clients and expenditures. This is the June 2007 snapshot. And what we saw in that month is there were about 146,000 enrollees. And we know that enrollee number can be higher at different times. That's really who is eligible and enrolled in the program. Not everyone who's enrolled at one point in time is receiving services in that month. People don't need medications necessarily on a 30-day, but maybe they get them on a 60-day basis, et cetera. So when we look at the percentage of people that actually received medications in June 2007, it was over 100,000 people, about 70% of those enrolled. And we know that thousands more are benefiting from being able to get their insurance paid for by ADAPs so they can get insurance coverage for their medications, which is also very critical. 10 states accounted for most of the clients who were served in June 2007, and they reflect the states that have the biggest caseloads. And this is the point I made earlier about who ADAPs are serving. You can see that most are people of color, low income, most are uninsured. And for those who aren't uninsured, they're underinsured. So the only reason that they're benefiting from an ADAP is because their current insurance is not able to cover what they need for medications. Most ADAP clients are men. That's partially a reflection of the epidemic in the United States, and also because one of the main programs that provides care and treatment to people with HIV in this country, Medicaid, is much harder for men to become eligible for. So ADAP, it would make sense that ADAPs would be filling that gap. The age range is mostly 25 to 44, so young adults. And then in terms of what kind of level of illness, that's very hard to gauge, but we do see that many have indications of advanced HIV disease if you measure that by CD4 count. So we again, see that ADAPs are serving the target population. In terms of drug expenditures and per capita spending, in June 2007, about $100 million was spent on drugs specifically, on prescriptions, and about $8-9 million more on insurance coverage. Insurance coverage tends to be less expensive per person than paying directly for medications. And here you can see the per capita drug spending of $982 estimated in the month of June 2007. Annualized, that's about $11,000 or so. This chart we always like to show because it makes a few different points. On the left side, on your left side, you see the drug expenditures, and on the right is prescriptions filled. And it shows you what classes are comprising most of the expenditures and most of the scripts. And I think one important thing to see here that is also reflected in the next slide is the cost of some of these. And you can see that the cost for antiretrovirals is higher than the others because they make up a greater share of expenditures than they do the scripts. And we track this over time, and that's something we see. We also this year are including multi-class medications as their own group here. Multi-class medications became available for the first time recently. They represent the combination of existing classes. We broke them out because there are some unique things about them, and we just wanted to be able to look at those. Okay. This shows ADAP expenditures per prescription by drug class to, again, show you that there's real differences here in the cost per prescription by the different classes, with fusion inhibitors being the most expensive, multi-class actually being more expensive as well, but they're multiple drugs in one. And trends. When we look over time at what's the trends are with the program, and we look at drug expenditures and clients served, in general, we see growing numbers, but at a decreasing rate. And this just shows you that. So that's one thing that we continue to see. And the other thing that we continue to see is that drug expenditures have always grown faster than clients, for the most part. So some overall findings about that: program expansion with client enrollment going up, client utilization going up, and drug expenditures going up. One of the other things that we were very much looking forward to looking at this year was the Part D impact. Last year, we saw the Part D impact, Medicare Part D, for the first time. And what that seemed to show us was, very briefly, there was a slight decrease in the number of clients served and expenditures in our monthly snapshot. And we weren't sure what that was about. We posited that it was probably the one-time effect of Part D going into place, where ADAPs moved clients into Part D and didn't expect that to continue. And in fact, that's what we've seen, that it hasn't continued. Clients have gone up. Drug expenditures have gone up again. And we believe this means more people are getting access through Part D. ADAPs were able to bring in more people. And the other thing is that not everyone who gets access through Part D has all the access that they need. So some of them are coming back into ADAP at different times, or ADAP is paying for parts of their Part D prescription drug benefit that they can't get covered or they can't afford on their own. So it was a one-time effect, but we do think it was a positive development. For the most part, we're hearing that from states, that it's really helped to expand access. So now I'm going to turn this over to Murray, who's going to walk us through some more findings, starting with the budget.
Good morning, everybody. I have to stop before I go on with the presentation and just say thank you to a couple of people. In particular, I do want to acknowledge Beth and Britton for their leadership in this program, because it's been essential for us at NASTAD, obviously, to continue this partnership in a very strong way, but they've really made this happen, and they should really be standing up here presenting. I get the beauty of standing up and presenting what somebody else has put together. So thank you, Beth and Britton. And Jan, thank you for the partnership as well. All right, I'm going to continue with the budget discussion a little bit. This is the challenging part because, as Jen mentioned, there are levers all over the place in the states. And many of you have heard me say this before, but if you've seen 1-8-APP, you've seen 1-8-APP, which means every state has a different picture, not only with the clients that they serve and the way they structure their program, but certainly with the budget composition. So from the perspective of the national 8-APP budget, we saw the budget in fiscal year 07. We're looking at fiscal year figures now, not June 07 figures. Fiscal year 07 budget nationally was about $1.43 billion. Of that, more than half was the 8-APP earmark funding. Now, it is a little bit tricky, and I'll talk a little bit more about 8-APP earmark funding. You can't take the appropriation that Congress puts into 8-APP earmark and just expect that it's going to all transfer over to 8-APP, particularly these days because of hold harmless requirements, because of some varying levers that go into place after HRSA gets the appropriation. And so this may not be the exact appropriation, but it's relatively close as far as the percentage or the amount of earmark funding that went out to 8-APPs. You can see that the other two major shares of the national 8-APP budget are the state appropriations, which in this case for fiscal year 07 was about 21%, and then drug rebates are another major component of the 8-APP budgets that states have to go and seek from pharmaceutical manufacturers if they're purchasing under a pharmacy network, and I'll get into that in a little bit as well. They're allowed to get rebates to get the prices of drugs down to the 340B public health service price or a little bit lower if negotiated. And so states are using about 20% of their budgets from drug rebates. And then you can see the other components as well that come in to the 8-APP budget. In particular, I do want to call attention to the 8-APP supplemental, as Jen mentioned, and you'll see in a slide in a moment that the 8-APP supplemental that was distributed to 8-APPs grew significantly from fiscal year 06 to 07, and it did allow states, as Jen mentioned, to increase some of their access. Okay, just the budget sources, you can see that all 8-APPs obviously are getting 8-APP earmark funding. The two other major components, as I mentioned earlier, were the state funding and the drug rebates. You can also see that smaller amounts or smaller numbers of states receive some of these other pieces of funding. The Part B base is one that I do want to call attention to because that's discretionary on the part of the state. If the state chooses or feels as though they've got the resources in Part B base to move it into 8-APP, they have that flexibility. Conversely, if a state has too much money in 8-APP, which I don't know is possible or actually happens, but they can't move 8-APP funding back into the Part B base. So there's some flexibility on the state's part to move Part B base into 8-APP if necessary. Another interesting component that we track every year is which states experience funding decreases in certain categories. The interesting piece here is that from an overall budget perspective, 18 states did experience a decrease in funding, but 31 states saw a decrease in their 8-APP earmark. That was primarily because 8-APP earmark last year was flat funded, essentially. And so when you start to move money around based on some of the changes in Ryan White, we saw a lot of decreases in the 8-APP earmark portion of the budget. So what that does is, as Jen mentioned, triggers some levers, and states are then having to go around and say, okay, we got a decrease over here. How are we going to fill this gap to make sure that the clients that we're serving continue to get access to medication? This slide just basically reinforces what we've already been saying. It shows the budget growth over time, and certainly you can see that the increases have been decreasing over time. So as we get further along into the monitoring of this, we see that the trend continues to go down as far as the amount of funding that's going up. So again, it just shows you a trend over time. ADAP earmark funding, here's where it gets a little bit more tricky, because we do see that the ADAP earmark funding has leveled off over time. We're not seeing major appropriations increases in Congress. We are seeing small increases. That doesn't necessarily translate into increases going to the programs, depending on hold harmless requirements. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It depends. In particular, you can see that we were basically level funded in this particular trend period, the 06 to 07 period. And you can see that the earmark has decreased almost to a no increase over time. Here's where I mentioned you can see the stark contrast from fiscal year 06 to fiscal year 07 in ADAP supplemental. This is an interesting piece that Ryan White reauthorization really did impact. In the past, HRSA was able to use the ADAP supplemental funding, which is that in fiscal year 06, you can see about a $9 million outlay of ADAP supplemental. The appropriation, if you want to figure what the appropriation was that year, it was about $23 million, I think, something like in the 20 range. HRSA used the rest of that funding that didn't go out to states to hold harmless other parts of ADAP. Therefore, ADAP supplemental was not going out to states that had demonstrated need. Ryan White reauthorization changed that and said, no more, you can't take ADAP, you can't take hold harmless money out of ADAP sup. Whatever the ADAP sup pot is, that money goes out to states. And you see the increase there, and you see the resulting effect that states were able to add new drugs to their formularies or actually increase their caseloads, take people off their waiting lists, and that's what we saw happen. So it was a very good thing from the perspective of ADAP supplemental actually going to the programs that needed that. State funding, this is another lever. We've seen that growing major leaps and bounds over time, but this last year we did see a slight decrease. It could be, we could explain it by ADAP supplemental went up. State said, well, if you got all this extra ADAP supplemental, we'll just not put as much into our state from our state coffers. It could be the economic downturn, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But states are using that however they need to make sure that their budgets are in line with the necessary people that are coming in and needing services. I will also say that there is some state match that's required, particularly on ADAP supplemental, unless you get a waiver, which sometimes you're eligible for and sometimes you're not. But most of this, most of the state funding is not required to go into the ADAP program. There is a state match associated with Part B, but it doesn't necessarily have to go into the ADAP program. So what you're seeing here is what states have, for the most part, chosen to put in to balance their budgets. Drug rebates is the area that I have said has continued to grow. It was actually the second largest driver of the budget growth. The other was ADAP supplemental this last year. It was obviously a major growth, and about fiscal year 2003, we started to see that just really start to increase, and that's really been filling the gaps in some states. The problem that we experience with drug rebates is that states have to actually actively seek that, and from a timing perspective, sometimes the timing is not such that it allows a regular flow of cash coming into the program to serve individuals. And so while drug rebates are an important part of the budget, they're not the only, they're not anything that states can readily depend on and continue to experience fluctuations in. So it is something that's important. We are continuing to work with states to make sure that they're capitalizing on their ability to pull those rebates in, because we know that they're an important part of the budget. All right, again, if you've seen one ADAP, you've seen one ADAP, and so we have demonstrated in the report some varying components of the ADAP programs. First of all, ADAP income eligibility as of December 31st. Now we're looking at a different snapshot of time again. You can see that there were 25 ADAPs that had their income eligibility above 300. And if you look at last year's report, this is one area where we did see some growth as a result of ADEP supplemental and some of the budgets growing. We saw that states were able to raise their income levels on several different components. Particularly, I think last year, if you look back, you'll see that North Carolina had 125% of FPL as their income eligibility. They're now above 200. So we see that everybody in all the ADEPs in the country are above 200 at least. But it's a varying degree. As Julie mentioned, another important component of this, some states would like to be able to raise their ADEP eligibility higher because they maybe have a little bit more resources to do it. But on the CARE side of things, there's also an income eligibility. So let's say an ADAP chose to raise their FPL to 300%, but they don't have the resources over in the CARE services for all the clients that are getting their medical care and their support services, and there's not enough money, so they keep their level at 200%. So we've got some varying kinds of income eligibility pieces going on that are important to consider. It's not just what an ADAP can do on their income eligibility. Coverage of antiretroviral drugs, as Jen said, we did see a strong movement on the part of all states to add the formulary requirements as new classes were approved. We had two new classes of drugs that were approved this last year, and states did move to pick up the drugs on that. You can see that most of the states cover, 29 states cover all of the antiretrovirals, and that 24 did not. This could be a result of some timing issues on our surveying because there were states that were in the process of adding new drugs that were approved at the time when we did this survey. So I think if we did this today, we'd probably see a little bit even better picture. The good news is that all the states are covering at least one of the drugs in all antiretroviral categories, and so we know that people are getting access to antiretroviral medications. A1 drugs, which are the drugs for treatment and prevention of opportunistic infections, is a little bit different picture, but generally you can see that the majority of ADAPs are covering most all of the recommended drugs, the A1 drugs, which are recommended by the guidelines. It's interesting to note that some states have their own programs in place for other medications. It might be a public hospital system, for instance. And so not all ADAPs are covering all of the drugs. In addition, some of the drugs that are on the A1 list, there are alternatives for, and so you may not have to have all of the drugs on to still treat or prevent the opportunistic infections. So just because a state does not choose to cover all of the 29 drugs does not mean they don't have a fairly full coverage of opportunistic infections. This is a slide that has changed fairly significantly from last year. If you remember, in last year's report, we had a waiting list map and we had a cost containment map. The good news this year is that we have those combined. Therefore, we've got fewer waiting lists and fewer cost containment measures. As Jen mentioned, there is one ADEP that still does report a waiting list. We had a brief period where there were no waiting lists. I think the good news is that there's not very many people on that waiting list, but nonetheless, as Jen said, it's important to keep in mind that some states still do struggle with their programs in order to make sure everyone has access. You can see that there are a few states that do have some cost containment measures in place. Waiting lists are only one indication of serious issues with ADAP's financial picture, so we do monitor other cost containment measures such as reduced eligibility, reduced formularies, other changes like cost sharing or things like that do impact a program. It's sometimes a little bit difficult to categorize whether it's a cost containment measure or just a function of the actual program design, and so we do try to monitor that on a regular basis and keep you updated as to what's happening there. As Jen also mentioned, Medicare Part D is an important wraparound, or ADAP is an important wraparound to Medicare Part D. There are deductibles, there are copays, there is the so-called donut hole, which we know clients experience, go into, never come out of, because ADAP expenditures don't actually count towards the true out-of-pocket expenditures. So ADAPTS have figured out how to wrap around Medicare Part D. And as Jen said, that's an in-and-out kind of situation. Clients are sometimes coming into ADAPT. They're going out at the beginning of the year when they get their Medicare benefits, et cetera, their Part D benefits. And so this is a slide that demonstrates what ADAPTS have chosen to do as far as wrap around with Medicare Part D. You can see that a good portion of states are doing deductibles, copays, and premiums, and then certainly we know that states are picking individuals up when they go into that donut hole, that coverage gap, so to speak, and providing medications during that. We also know, as Jen said, that last year we did experience some shifting of clients out of ADAP into Medicare Part D, and so that growth has stopped, obviously, and now the client growth in ADAPs has continued to increase. As I mentioned earlier, there are states that receive drug rebates, and one of the things that we also keep a really close eye on is how states are purchasing their medications. Approximately half of the states, actually it's 29, purchase directly, which means that they purchase directly from through a wholesaler. They purchase at a 340B price, at the lowest public health service price available to all 340B entities. So a little more than half of the states purchase that way. They're getting the benefits of the lowest price up front. The other states, many because of distribution systems, choose to purchase through a pharmacy network. They choose to go to a retail pharmacy and purchase the drugs at a higher price, then they're eligible for rebates to get their prices down to that 340B level. They do that because they can use a chain of pharmacies and access to those drugs is better in those particular states. And it's a decision that a state can make as to which way they purchase depending on their own situation. So there are 24 ADAPs that purchase through the pharmacy network model where they purchase at a higher price and then apply for rebates. That's where you're seeing the rebate income come into those states, and that's where you're seeing some challenges in making sure the money's coming in, but they choose to do that because of the access that their clients can then have to medications through local pharmacies. Obviously, we're looking forward, and we will continue to look forward. We know that the role of ADAPTS will continue as an important part, certainly because we know there's more and more people living with HIV and AIDS. And we know that as other programs change, such as Medicare Part D, I do want to emphasize that Medicare Part D benefits change every year. And so ADAPTS are having to adapt based on what Medicare Part D is doing. And I'll give one example. Some ADAPs are using their funds to pay for premiums for individuals that are on Medicare Part D. They're paying their Medicare Part D premiums. They can pay. Some state or some programs, some plans have no coverage gap. If you are in that plan, you might pay a higher premium. Some states have been choosing to purchase under those plans, thereby eliminating the coverage gap. Well, that changes every year. Plans change every year in Medicare Part D, and that might not be available next year. And so a state may change their Medicare Part D wraparound based on the Medicare Part D benefits that are in place. And we know that Medicaid changes every year, too, in states. And so as those programs change, it causes a chain reaction, if you will, to ADAP, who then has to change their their budget picture or their policies in order to wrap around some of these programs. The other things that we'll continue to monitor, certainly as Ryan White reauthorization continues to be implemented, I want to mention something about the budget. It's been very complicated this year. Doug will probably talk about this, but the Part B and ADAP awards just came out in the last couple of days. There were some very challenging moments as far as the appropriation levels, which changed at the last minute. They didn't change. They were wrong in a lot of our materials. Doug discovered it, actually, I think. Well, some of his people did. And it caused a chain reaction of a lot of different shuffling and juggling at the very last minute to make sure that the awards were appropriately done. Part of that you have to factor in hold harmless, you have to factor in all these different requirements that have to be in place. We haven't seen the full results of Ryan White reauthorization yet. We've got a carryover requirement that states have to spend 98% of their award or some penalties kick into place. That hasn't. We haven't seen the effects of that yet this year. We'll see it next year. And so as Ryan White continues its implementation, we're continuing to see some impacts. We're going to keep watching the waiting lists. We're going to continue monitoring Part D and what's happening. And an important piece is the state fiscal situation. We've been hearing a lot about the economic downturn and what states are experiencing. So what's that going to mean for ADAPS next year? We'll see. And then finally, just our budget levels, budget levers, and the predictability and stability of some of these funding sources. Again, state funding, the drug rebates, other sources that ADAPS use to make sure that their budgets are in place. And then we're going to continue to monitor, obviously, the variability of programs. In the report this year, as Jen mentioned, we first now are starting to look at some regional variations, and we've noted that in a couple of places. One real important regional variation that I didn't mention, we didn't even highlight on the slides, is that in ADAP supplemental, all of the ADAP supplemental states were in the south, and there's a couple more in the I don't remember, it's the West region, I think, or something like that. But there were no ADAP supplemental states in the Northeast. And so if you start to look at some regional comparisons, you start to see some things that indicate the epidemic, just like you said. And the ADAP programs have well responded to meeting the challenges of the epidemic. So with that, I will turn it over to Jen.
Thank you. That actually was quite an education on how ADAPs work, I think. And they're very, very complicated. So I will ask our panelists some questions. But when we get to the questions from you all, if you have questions, you know, about hold harmless, rebates, supplemental, all of the things that you heard about, please ask us, because that's one of the things I think we can tell you from the national and HRSA perspective, but also states who are actually having to implement all of these complicated things. One other point I wanted to highlight before I went to questions around the formularies, because that's another complicated area, the formulary requirement, et cetera. And one of the things we saw that was interesting to us was that there were two new classes of drugs that were where drugs were approved for the first time very recently. States have a grace period before they have to add those to their ADAPs, and all the states added them before that period had come. So I think that's another telling finding, that states are ready and wanting to provide that access. So I'm going to turn to our panel. One of the things we try to do each year is find 2 to 3 states who can try to represent the country, not really, but just represent different perspectives, particularly what we're seeing in the report. I'm going to start with Noreen from South Carolina, because last year at this time, we were highlighting the fact that South Carolina, unfortunately, had the largest waiting list in the country with several hundred people. It was a crisis, and we actually released a video at that time that talked about, gave voice to clients in that state that were struggling with that crisis. It got a lot of attention. It got attention as far away as in Europe. There was some attention to it. So it was a big deal. And South Carolina is here today without a waiting list. So from being in that position to now, I thought Noreen could tell us a little bit about how that happened, why that happened, and what does it all mean? I mean, what are the lessons there?
Well, Jen, as you said, we had the unfortunate distinction of having the largest wait list in the country last year. In South Carolina, we implemented a wait list in June of 2006 and were unable to eliminate it until September of 2007. It reached a high of almost 600 people. So it was a very significant event in our state. And there were a couple things that happened that allowed us to eliminate that wait list. The first and in some ways most important thing that happened was that a group of community-based organizations in the state that serve people living with HIV and AIDS, they came together, they formed a grassroots advocacy organization, and they advocated for the ADAP with our state legislature. Without them, we wouldn't have been able to get additional funds from the state legislature. Prior to last year, we were getting $500,000 from the South Carolina State Legislature. Because of the efforts of this group, we now have an additional $3 million of recurring funds. So we have $3.5 million recurring state funds. We also got $1 million of one-time funds last year for a total of $4.5 million from the state legislature. That was huge. We also, the second piece of that puzzle was the ADEP supplemental, and our increase from the prior year to last year was very significant. So those two pieces allowed us to eliminate that wait list. We also, in echoing some of the comments about care services, we also did, as I say, borrow from our base $2 million to put towards our ADAP. We didn't want to do that because then that squeezes our providers. You know, someone has to be keeping the patients adherent and writing the prescriptions, actually. But that was another piece of that puzzle. So with those three pots of money, we were able to eliminate that wait list.
And can you talk a little bit about the supplemental? One of the things Murray mentioned was that all the states, or most of the states that got it, were in the South. The supplemental itself, can you just describe for people what its purpose is and therefore why South Carolina was able to access it?
Well, for us, it was, we used it purely for drugs. I mean, that was our need, and so that's how we used it. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking.
In other words, and the supplemental is designed for states that have extra, particular demonstrated needs. So there's some gap that state is really experiencing, and I think the fact that the states that got the supplemental now are mostly in the South just tells you where some of those gaps were, which is other things we've been hearing. Not that other parts of the country don't have challenges, but that particular challenge is met by the supplemental. Okay, why don't we turn to Christine, a very different state, South Dakota, a much smaller ADEP caseload, probably doesn't get as much attention as some of the other states, but also, unfortunately, until recently, had the distinction of every year we'd have to call out in our report, South Dakota is the only state in the country that doesn't cover any protease inhibitors. Well, now South Dakota, by law, has to and does. But what was interesting in looking at the findings was the state doesn't just cover one protease inhibitor, which is actually what the policy would require, at least one medication from each class. The state covers all protease inhibitors and also added the two new drugs from the new classes before they had to. So how did that happen? Why did that happen? And can you tell us? And it was great to be able to say in the report that all states are covering at least one drug in every class.
South Dakota was very fortunate in that we could document that we had 100 living AIDS cases. What that allowed was it allowed us to increase our base funding. Our funding increased almost double. So we were able to add all the protease inhibitors, all the drugs. How we decided to do that was we surveyed all the HIV priority doctors, we call them in the state. There are 9 of them. And we asked them which drug they felt we should add. The response that we received from them was that there was not just one drug that they could pick, that in order to serve their clients better and to the best of their ability, they needed them all added, and that they would make a very informed and conscientious decision as to how to use the drugs. So we took that advice back to our advisory council, which is made up of doctors, nurses, pharmacists, clients with HIV and AIDS, and just some concerned citizens. And they agreed to approve all of them. And we knew that there was a possibility that other classes would need to be added. And at that point, they also made the decision to add all of them as they came out. We've done that. We'll monitor it, and if we need to, then we will re-implement our waiting list again. And that's how we accomplished it.
So that was a critical piece that there's no waiting list now, but that could...
Correct. Before we got our increased funding, our waiting list max was about 86 people. As we got our increased funding, we were able to eliminate that.
And talk a little bit about the state does not provide any state funding to ADAP, and what's the implication of that for supplemental? And
we were eligible for supplemental funding, but we could not apply for the waiver because we could not make the 1-to-4 required match because our state does not make any funding for our program.
Again, a lot of this is complicated, but it really does play out in these ways at the state level. And both of those states were able to eliminate waiting lists by other things going into place. I want to turn it over to Doug now to talk a little bit more broadly about Ryan White reauthorization and what we heard and how's playing out more generally at the national level and what some of the issues are there.
Thank you, Jen, and let me thank the sponsors for inviting me to this forum this morning. I think for us back at the Health Resources Services Administration HIV AIDS Bureau, it was not a a year of boredom, shall we say. We spent a lot of time working on implementation of the Ryan White Care Act, and I think a number of the changes that affect ADAP were noted by in the report by both you, Jen, and Murray. But I think it's critical to note that the fact that we are now have an increased supplemental ADAP appropriation, what we call the ADAP supplemental, has gone from 3% to 5%, and the fact that all of those dollars are now directed towards states who have severe need. As in the past, as Murray pointed out, and the report points out, we used to use some of those dollars to meet the whole harmless requirements. I think the waiver of the match in certain circumstances has helped some states. It still hasn't addressed what I consider the problem in very small states that don't have an ongoing match requirement, and therefore the larger states that do, they can ask for a waiver, but some of the smaller states it still has acted as a barrier for the ADAP supplemental program. A couple of things, though, I do want to mention in terms of the appropriation. The appropriation did increase, and because of that, the ADAP sup will go up slightly this year as well. We are still seeing, I do want to make clear, I think something that Murray said earlier in his presentation, all of the dollars that are appropriated for the ADAP earmark go into ADAP services. If we have to meet whole harmless requirements, we actually, the Peter from Paul case in this case is now the base. And that's where we generate a lot of dollars from in order to meet the whole harmless requirement beyond what we now call the pro rata reduction. I also want to point out, though, that the ADAP appropriations over time, or actually awards, can change for a number of three factors. The appropriation level, the requirement for whole harmless, and this year the whole harmless requirement is up to 100% of last year's award as opposed to 95% in prior years, and the case count change. And the case count change is, I think, very important for people to note because in the new act, we are now required to use living cases of HIV and AIDS from both name-based and code-based states. And we've seen cases go up from the cases that we used in 07 to 08, and particularly in some of those code-based states as well. So those three factors can affect the actual award amount that a state gets for both the ADAP earmark award and the supplemental award. But I think it's important to note that over time we are concerned that even with the movement to now six core classes of ARVs on everybody's formulary, we are concerned about some of the state trends and economics. We're hearing things about what states are doing. We also are concerned, I think one of the big priorities of the Bureau, the HIV AIDS Bureau, has been looking at whether or not we have sufficient number of providers, competently trained HIV care providers who can meet the demand for growing services. And so that is an ongoing concern. But I think the report does highlight a lot of good things about the program. I will note that nationally, ADAP served over 150,000 people in calendar year 2006, and I think that number will grow again as we get data on 2007. But the challenges remain, I think, and states have been living up to those challenges very well.
We're going to get to the state fiscal condition in a minute, but I want to actually ask Murray if he will explain to everybody a little bit about what is hold harmless, and also this issue of moving to living HIV cases, and something that Doug said, and I just want to have everyone understand, which is if the case counts go up, which is it was good, it's reflective of epidemics, but how that relates to the appropriation, and then how that might relate to award, you know, all of how this all plays out.
I should let Doug explain it because he runs the formulas, not me. But the law calls for incorporation of HIV and AIDS cases, and so I think the first thing HRSA does is they'll take and they look at their appropriation for ADAP. They run the case counts. They say, okay, state X, you have 3% of the nation's cases, therefore you would get 3% of the nation's or the ADAP appropriation. That's the starting place. That's where you start, and you would think that that shifts money around. It does, essentially, to begin with. But then you have this little thing called the hold harmless requirements, which kick in. In this particular case, as Doug said, the requirement is that the award this year needs to be 100% of what it was last year. With no essentially increase in appropriations, there's no money to put into the states that need to be at 100% that aren't at 100%. So let's say a state lost some of the nation's share of HIV and AIDS cases, and they went to 95% of their award. They needed 5% of hold harmless funding into their award to make sure that the hold harmless requirement is met. Well, there was really very little money to actually fund that this year, so they had to pull from states that had more than 100%, and then further reduce some awards in what's called a pro rata reduction, which the law calls for, if there's not enough money available, to reduce awards down below 100% if necessary in order to get everybody. It's so complicated. All I can say is, from our perspective, and I think most of the programs would probably agree, there's some stability this year, which there, you know, everybody is feeling a big sigh of relief on, that there wasn't this major fluctuation of either income or decrease in ADAP funding. So it did seek to stabilize, and I think we are happy that the law does call for some stability factors so that we don't have this major fluctuation that states have to respond to.
Before I turn to Ron, one other question. Since we keep hearing a lot about the Part B base and the base and the importance of the base, can you tell us a little bit about what is that fund? What are those things that we're hearing about that are so important that may not get as much attention as an ADAP but are critical components?
Well, it obviously funds medical care. I mean, that's one of the biggest components of what's funded. But it also can fund support services. There is now a requirement in the CARE Act for Parts A and B that 75% of funding needs to go to core medical services, and there's a list of 13 core medical services that can be funded out of that 75%. The other 25% would be things like support services, transportation, child care, nutrition, some things like that that actually help people stay in care. 25% of a state's award can go to that. So from a state perspective, mostly it's funding medical care, and that's the important component, is making sure that, as Noreen said, individuals have prescriptions, that they can get prescriptions so that they can then in turn get their
And program. As Doug said, that there's enough providers available that are doing this. So let's turn to the state environment and the fiscal picture more broadly. And anyone who's living in the United States now knows where I guess the recession word has been uttered, housing crisis, all kinds of economic woes. And states are starting to, well, have been experiencing this and talking more and more about it. And so what we're showing you is somewhat of a reflection of a few months ago, for the most part, although we have some, you know, I mentioned earlier that just yesterday we heard from Montana that, unfortunately, the only state with a waiting list of three people, that waiting list is up to six, and they're worried that there will be more people soon. How that connects to their state fiscal picture is unknown, but potentially plays a role. So we thought we needed to have some expertise on that whole area of discussion, and we turned to NCSL, and Ron Snell's here to share that perspective with us. And then maybe we'll hear a little bit from our two state reps about if they're experiencing anything, and then we'll turn to your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Jen. It's an honor to be here and to be part of this panel. NCSL and the Kaiser Family Foundation have a long relationship of working together on projects. It's good to be able to continue that with my contribution today. As you heard, state fiscal condition is certainly mixed, and things don't seem to be improving. We are in the midst right now of surveying the 50 states to have precise and exact information available, and we'll publish an update, a state budget outlook, on April 25th. In the meantime, this is what I can tell you. It looks to us, on the basis of impressionistic information, that around one-third of the states are experiencing fairly significant fiscal problems and do not expect those to improve in the course of the next year. Around a third of the states, maybe a little more, are saying that their condition is relatively stable. A small number of states, and unfortunately mostly states with relatively small populations, are saying that things are as good as they ever have been. Now, you can instantly deduce that those are states that have mineral wealth of some sort and are benefiting from high coal, oil, natural gas prices. So a state like Alaska, Wyoming, to some extent my home state of Colorado, North Dakota, mostly western states, mostly Rocky Mountain states, mostly states with small populations, are doing exceptionally well. The largest states and the states that for a brief time benefited from the housing bubble are those that are doing the worst. Florida, California are two of the states with the most significant fiscal difficulty, And so let me say just one word about how housing prices translate into problems for the program that you were working with. States don't benefit directly from housing prices. Property taxes, to some extent, depend on housing prices, but property taxes mostly go to local governments, and they change slowly because the prices of housing, as they fall or as they increase, are very slowly translated into different property tax levels. Eventually, that will affect state government, but that's not what's happening right now. What does happen is construction and the purchase of new houses. When you buy a house, you don't stop with buying a house. You buy a refrigerator, you buy furniture, you buy rugs, and you pay sales taxes on all of that, and you create jobs. You create jobs in the construction industry, you create jobs in retail, and those jobs pay income taxes. Also, when you're buying a house, though you don't realize it when you do so, you're paying a lot of sales tax on the materials that went into that construction. Almost every state collects nearly as much sales tax from business as it from business purchases as it does from your personal retail purchases. And a lot of that comes from the construction industry. As lumber, other materials used in construction are generally subject to the sales tax. So when construction slows, which we've seen catastrophically fall, that means those collections fall off. A special thing about construction is those are local jobs. Those are people, obviously, who have to be here in Maryland, Virginia, Florida, California. Those are jobs that cannot be outsourced. And so when construction falls off, we lose local jobs. Those people lose purchasing power. Their income tax obligations fall. And that's how the housing crisis translates through into state budgets, and that's what we're seeing working through now, both in the states that experienced remarkable bubbles like Arizona, California, Florida, some of the other coastal states on both coasts, and in states that are more remote from that as this issue and the credit crunch work through the economy. What we're expecting to see at NCSL when we get the results of our current fiscal survey within a couple weeks is that the problems are greatest in the states with the biggest population, with an exception of Texas, which seems to be doing well, but the other top 10 states are seeing slowing economies. We're not seeing significant problems in this fiscal year in financing state government because states carried substantial reserves into this fiscal year. At the beginning of the fiscal year, which for states runs from July through June, at the beginning of this fiscal year, state reserves were about as high as they ever have been, and so that's a cushion. Those reserves tend to run out, and we'll probably see, because, you know, in many states, tax collections are falling in absolute terms, not just growing slowly. They're falling in absolute terms. We're probably going to see tighter budgets, less spending in fiscal year 09, which begins this summer, and possibly carrying through to fiscal year 10, because I don't think anybody who's concerned with state finances sees this slowdown as something that is going to resolve itself quickly. Jen mentioned the dread R-word, recession. And whenever you see that mentioned in the newspapers, in the media, you hear it, you immediately hear that there's controversy over whether we are in a recession or not. The controversy is a very technical question because there is a technical expert definition of a recession. But what we're seeing nationally is a slowdown in investment, which is one of the drivers of the American economy. We're seeing a growth in unemployment. We're seeing slowing growth of job creation. Fewer jobs are being created. We're seeing tax collections fall, and state sales tax collections are one of the best leading indicators of the economy because they tell you where sales are, how much money people are spending, and we're a consumer-driven economy. You guys stop maxing out your credit cards, we're in trouble. And that's a great leading indicator. It tells you which direction we're going. So technically a recession, who knows? We'll know that in a year or so, and the economists can look back and say, oh, this is what happened in April of 08. But all of the other indicators are pretty depressing. And so I would say that for, you know, lots of money lying around for the remaining states to create their appropriations for this year, that is not the situation. So that's about where we are. I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Two other questions, and then I actually will go to your questions. Tell us a little bit about when states have to do budgets, what's different about a state budgeting process versus the federal government? And then the other thing is when states are faced with having to balance budgets, that's where I'm getting to, but also with tightening fiscal conditions, where do they usually look to? What programs tend to get cut?
Well, thanks, Jen. Those are very good questions. In one way, state budgeting is very like federal budgeting, and that is in the fact that in recent years there has been less flexibility available to policymakers because more and larger sums of money are simply built into the budget. Commitments have to be kept. In states, those commitments are primarily to education and to health care. And in both cases, you can say, well, there is the power in state government to cut those appropriations. There is the power, but education is so broad-based a service that it is virtually impossible to cut state spending for K-12 education. And in recent years, higher education has been pushed in and squeezed to such an extent that it is very difficult to cut higher education further. Higher education, K-12 education, and healthcare among them make up about two-thirds of the money that states can appropriate from their general funds. And so the remaining third covers everything else that states do, from the park service to administering the legislature, the governor, a whole variety of things. But those are the two big lumps, education and health care, which makes health care, you might think, vulnerable. It also is, although technically vulnerable, a very, very difficult area of expenditure for states to reduce because, as was pointed out with the waiting list in Montana, which has grown from 3 to 6 people, it's not a big number, but there are lives at stake. And that is an issue that policymakers are, of course, very, very sensitive to. The reason this becomes a crunch is the answer to the second half of Jen's question. The way that state budgeting is quite unlike federal budgeting, and that is that in every state there is a policy imperative, and in almost every state, a legal imperative that budgets be balanced. And what that means has a little flexibility in it, but basically what it means in legislators' minds, who take this more seriously probably than anybody else in the country, who are the people who should take it seriously, what it means is that what they spend is limited by what they're taking in the course of a given fiscal year. There's an enforcement mechanism. That's, first of all, different from the federal government, where that is not the case. And the second difference is that for this, there's an enforcement mechanism in states. The federal government can borrow money simply by lifting the lid on the national debt. And once that happens, the borrowing occurs automatically. State governments are unable to do that. To borrow money requires at least a vote of a legislature that gets a lot of publicity. In many states, it takes a vote of the people, which puts it out into an altogether different arena. So there's an enforcement mechanism that keeps budgets balanced, and that means if revenues fall, then something has to give. Traditionally, the balance wheel is higher education. And that has always created a serious problem in recessions, not only because spending is cut, because also in recessions, the demand for higher education increases. Health programs are among those that states try to maintain at least a steady state in recessions because, like higher education, they're programs that see increasing demand. Think of Medicaid, for example. Demand invariably increases for Medicaid programs when economies are weak. So this forces very difficult decisions on policymakers. they tend to use mechanisms like shifting capital expenditure from current revenues, this year's money, to bonds, which can free up some money. They look for holding employment steady, not creating jobs. But eventually, I think, when things get truly bad, which is not where we are at present, I would hasten to say we're not at that situation yet, they have to look at core programs of education and health care. And that's when you have to be very alert as to what's going on.
And I would think that that would affect, even if things are held at the same, it's not, increases could be affected. All right, now we're going to get to your questions. I feel more educated on how this is all connected, so thank you very much. Please.
Hi, Carl Schmidt at the AIDS Institute. The report was pretty optimistic today, our rosy scenario of the ADAP programs and how they've gotten better this last year. And I guess I have a couple questions. Does that mean everyone in the United States who needs antiretrovirals and other medications are getting them? And it looks like the components that got to where we are today are just a one-time change with reauthorization, maybe Medicare Part D. So I'm really concerned, what is the outlook for the future? Both Murray and Doug talked about that things are kind of constant right now, and the awards this year that just came out, you know, that have to last for the next year, were really basically the same as last year. But what about all the people who are getting infected? What about the new cases coming in because of testing? People living longer. So I guess I'm more interested in what is the outlook for the future, particularly without an increase in appropriations.
Well, it's certainly something that, as we look forward, we are concerned about as well. I think a couple of things. First of all, we know that not everyone that is needing care is in care. Doesn't mean just because there aren't waiting lists that there's not unmet need out there as far as ADAPs go. You know, there are 25% of the population, HIV infected population, that don't know their status, and then there's another 25% that may know their status but are not in care. And so, you know, of those individuals that are not in care, that are not in the system, we don't know exactly what that demand is for ADAPs. We know there's certainly a demand there. The other thing is there is a huge increased attention from the CDC's perspective on testing and knowing your status, and rightly so. I mean, we want to identify the individuals that are infected that are not identified, and we want to get them into care. But there is a significant scale up in our prevention efforts, in testing efforts, to identify individuals that are not currently in the system. And certainly the impact of that, Carl, is going to be something that we're going to watch really closely. The demand that that has on care services, and particularly ADAPs, is where we usually see some of those demands first off. So I think that's something that we need to continue to look at. We know that ADAPs grow by about 100 to $110 million every year, and that's based on the need that is there. Without an increased appropriation, without additional federal earmarks coming into the program, obviously that money is going to have to come from somewhere if states are indeed going to meet the demand that continues to come forward.
Doug, one second. I'm going to ask Maureen to talk a little bit about something she was telling me about South Carolina looking at this very question and feeling pretty good that they didn't have a waiting list, but some other information that they had was giving them pause on that count.
Well, that's right, Jen. Right now we're in a good position to meet the need that we currently have. We also have two new significant testing initiatives going on in our state, and we expect that to yield a significant number of new positives to our system. We're also looking at a retention in care or an adherence project within our ADAP. Right now our monthly utilization is about 70%, so in any given month we have 30% of the people enrolled in our ADAP are not getting their meds refilled. We know that that's a problem, not just for the individuals, but a public health issue. So that's something that, beginning this year, we're targeting in terms of being able to collect that data and work with case managers and work with providers to get people to be more adherent. Well, that will cost more money because more people will fill their scripts every month. So, you know, every month we're looking at the amount of dollars of drugs dispensed, the amount of people that new applications, and the whole picture. And while we're in a good position now, we know that we can go from good position to not so good, meaning waiting lists, in a short period of time.
Didn't you do an unmet need analysis recently in the state that reflects kind of what Murray was saying about the national picture?
That's right. Sadly, there is about half of the people living with HIV and AIDS in the state are not in care. That's a big number of people. And if all those people came in today, which is what we want, the system would really, really feel it.
Doug, did you
want? Well, I think I wanted to go back to Carl's earlier question. I think the stability that we see so far is that what we know is that our whole harmless requirement for 09 will remain the same as 08. The president's proposed budget is essentially a flat line. What I can't predict is how HIV, living cases of HIV and AIDS will change, nor can I predict the demand that will be on services, not just ADAP, but on general in terms of getting people into care and some of the issues that states, individual states, are going to be faced with. And as if you remember my three factors about what makes an award here, changes in any one of those three factors can essentially move money around in a way that a state didn't necessarily contemplate, except for the whole harmless, which then starts to play around with what people thought they may have will receive. And the other issue is, of course, reauthorization next year. Congress will have to take a look at the current law and take an affirmative action to continue the program or some other steps. So that we are not clear about what will happen in the future, and I can't predict it. So I think that's a level of uncertainty that we don't know about.
Thank you very much. Christine Lubinsky, HIV Medicine Association. A comment and a question. The comment is thank you so much for linking this program so explicitly to the provision of care. Finally, those of us who represent medical providers kind of get frustrated that it's been there's been such concerted advocacy around ADAP and not necessarily a concurrent advocacy around the need for the medical care to support that. Writing scripts to manage this disease is a very complicated business, and I would just encourage you, to the extent possible, to do more of that. For example, I thought it was very interesting to hear that some states are hesitant to increase their ADAP eligibility because they have capped eligibility on access to care. I think those of us who advocate for this program here in Washington and would like to support increases to the Title II base would like to know more. My question is really about Medicare Part D. And I, for one, was kind of disappointed to see the state figures on support for Medicare Part D. So while half the states are providing some support to Medicare beneficiaries, the other half are not. And I think one could argue that those could be the most vulnerable beneficiaries of all, because we all know that virtually all people on waiting lists are, in fact, participating in pharmacy assistance programs, so they are getting access to their drugs. And I think given what we know about copays and Medicare Part D, people may very well be choosing between one drug and another. The question is have you asked the states who are not able to provide, whether it's premium or copay support for Medicare Part D beneficiaries, if their posture would change if we were successful at the federal level in getting ADAP to count towards TROOP, so that they would know that at least there was a finite commitment they were making to that population? Because I think, again, in advocating for that here in Washington, that would be very useful information. Thanks.
Christine, you're exactly right. I think that while we haven't asked the explicit question, I think we know that certainly if ADAP expenses did count towards TROOP, that certainly it would allow more flexibility to wrap around. Absolutely. The other thing I will say is that this is a moving target. We did a snapshot, and if you'll notice, those data on the Medicare wraparound was from almost a year ago. It was from May of 07, and we know that the implementation of the Medicare Part D in ADAPs took a significant amount of time to scale up, where ADAPs had to figure out how to do the wraparound. And so we'll continue to monitor that. My suspicion is that is improving and the condition is improving. Certainly it doesn't mean that we're all the way there yet, but I think that your points are absolutely well taken.
Let me just add something to this discussion, because I think it's important to note that there are a number of states who fund not only insurance purchase under ADAP, but also the insurance continuation project, which they can do out of the Part B base. But as we've been talking to states about the whole issue of client-level data and how do we move there, we've heard a lot about the administrative complexities of tracking all these various Medicare Part D programs and plans, the whole issue of paying out private insurance plans that bill monthly, quarterly, different dates, different days of the month. And it requires an administrative capacity that a lot of the larger states have, but some of the smaller states don't. And while we like the idea of being able to use private insurance or health coverage in other areas, it is becoming more and more complicated and more difficult for a small state, and we've experienced this, small states that have two or three people doing everything. And bringing on a fourth person only to do that may put them at the brink where they may be able not to sort of do this thing. So there are some issues here that I think states are also struggling with.
That's a really good point. It's not just the payer of last resort. It's also often the last. Christine, I know, is only part-time on ADAP because she's running other things in the state. So it's definitely a challenge. I think there are other questions. There's probably time for about two or three more questions.
Hi. I'm Lauren Broussard. I'm with the Office for HIV/AIDS Policy. And right now we're working on the second year of the National HIV Testing Mobilization Campaign. And I kind of wanted to hear some suggestions from the panel as we go out to especially non-traditional populations and encourage people to go get tested and introduce them to services in their area should they test positive. How would you suggest that we portray this financial picture to them, being realistic, or do we continue to be optimistic and encourage them to seek these services? How would you suggest portraying that to people?
Well, I think we always hear the argument when we say we're testing all these people, what do we do if we find these people? And it's often, if you build it, they will come response from when you hear policymakers, et cetera. And I think we certainly would never want to characterize when we're trying to test individuals and get people to know their status that there might not be something available for them. Obviously, the one thing that I will say that I'm most proud about with this program is that the administrators and state folks that are doing this work really, really, really want to provide access to everybody. So no one ever wants to institute a waiting list. And I hear discussions, and probably if I would ask our panelists up here, we would hear, we didn't want to do this. It's not like we wanted to do that. The other thing that I think is really important is that these states that do have waiting lists work really, really hard at getting access to medications through pharmacy assistance programs with manufacturers. I know Noreen talks about their case managers in South Carolina when they were managing the waiting lists had an incredible caseload of individuals that they were trying to get medications for. So I think the message is be optimistic, but yet everybody be advocating for additional resources to make sure the programs can continue to serve individuals. We know that pharmacy assistance programs and the stopgap kind of measures are not the way to provide consistent medical care and treatment.
And I would just add, I think another message is know your status. It's just so important to know your status. And ADAP isn't the only program. I mean, there's a lot of other programs that people are eligible for or can access in different states. So I think we want to be optimistic about why it's important for people to know their status while at the same time recognizing that there are limitations at different times.
Bob Roy, the Bay Area Reporter. Part of the way that ADAP was originally conceived and sold to the public in many ways was sort of a safety net of safety nets, in that people would be generally be on it for short term, trying to get into other existing programs, things like that. Could you talk a little bit about the churn in terms of the membership of people participating in the program and how long some of the people are remaining on the program? Is it for years on end or is it relatively short term?
Why don't we ask our state representatives to tell us a little bit about that?
In addressing that question, simply put, I can say, yes, we have many people on the program who are on for years, and we think that's a good thing. In our state, it's difficult to access Medicaid. ADEP is still serving as the safety net, but we have people, and again, we're delighted when we see, oh, this guy's been in the system 10 years, 11 years, 12 years. You know, that's great. That means he's adherent. That means we're providing that service and that continuity, and that's wonderful. But, you know, so we do have some people that will come in and out of care, and those are the people who, in our state, sort of felt it. Be if maybe they were removed from the program for non-adherence, and then all of a sudden June came around, and there was a wait list, and then they were kind of left hanging. But so we definitely see people that are around for a long time.
What about Christine in South Dakota?
We have quite a few clients that have been on the program since our program started. I can echo what Noreen said. We have people that have been on for a very long time, 15 years. And they're continue to be on our program. We also have those that go in and out, and those are the ones that we worry about the most, I guess. And it's hard to guarantee that they will be able to get back on the program, but at this point, they have been able to.
And I would just add one thing, and your point about, you know, Congress intended it to be a safety net of safety nets. In an ideal world where we had a healthcare system that was fully functioning and really caring for individuals, we would see people using this as a stopgap measure. But because of our fractured healthcare system, obviously individuals are relying on this as their care. So I think that's an important point as well.
Thank you. Tim Boyd from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. During the presentation, there was reference to the drug purchasing mechanism states use. It was noted that the rebate states, their savings for drug prices comes at the back end and is often unreliable, whereas the direct purchase states get the savings up front and do get, often has been reported, lower prices than the rebate model. Murray pointed out the fact that states choose the rebate model for better formulary access. And looking at least what's in the report that was handed out here, there are many states that use the direct purchase model that don't, that have full formulary access. I was just wondering if you can comment kind of on the purchasing models further, and also other reasons states would use the rebate model.
It's not necessarily formulary access, but it's pharmacy access. So it's distribution of the medications. Large states oftentimes will use a pharmacy network because it gives individuals in concentrated population areas access to different choices as far as pharmacies, et cetera. So it is about access to pharmacies, not necessarily the formularies themselves. The other thing that I will say is that the Ryan White program requires that rebates be spent in the program. So it requires that the rebates be either purchasing drugs or supportive services kind of things to provide for drugs if the state can demonstrate that those drugs are being provided for. It is a very complex system of determining whether or not you can institute direct purchase versus a rebate. We have seen a few states that have switched over from a rebate to a direct purchase model, but there are costs associated with going to a direct purchase as well. You've got to have a mechanism to distribute the drugs, for instance. You've got to either have a central pharmacy and then have a way to get those drugs out to individuals because you're not relying on pharmacy networks. You've got to do mail order, or you've got to do something else. So there are some things that there are some choices that states make based on distribution and access.
And those are larger infrastructure questions that states may or may not have that aren't specific to ADAP. Okay.
That's correct. Okay. Some states have a central pharmacy, for instance, in their larger health programs that can accommodate something like this. Others do not have those mechanisms.
I think we have time for one more question. And then if there is one.
Hi, thank you for presenting this panel this morning. I'm from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and I have a question with regard to the waiting list and sort of the ethical implications and the ethical decision-making process in implementing a waiting list. And what steps do you guys take to, and this is addressed to the ADAP directors, to ensure that other cost containment measures are used first before resorting to a waiting list, or is there just not enough time foreseeing into budget crunches and having to implement a waiting list?
Well, first, I'll start by saying that we are always operating as fiscally responsible as we can. We only spend 3% of our ADAP budget on admin, and our formulary, while not as expansive as other formularies, we do cover all the ARVs, and 98% of our drug budget is spent on ARVs. And so we, you know, even when we're not in a crisis, we're operating pretty tightly. In terms of the ethical implications and access to drugs, the first thing we did when we saw a waitlist coming was we got all the case managers from all around the state. We had a big training to make sure that they had the tools they needed to work with the patients so that they could access the drugs through the pharmaceutical industry. So that was the first thing we did. We felt like, well, that's something we have to provide. Even though a lot of our case managers had those skills or had that ability, we wanted to make sure because, it was really a lot of us sort of actually took it personally that we had to have this wait list, and it was a hard time. But we feel like we did everything fiscally responsible and programmatically responsible to make sure we responded as best we could.
We do not want a late waiting list again. We don't like them. We pretty much did not have any problem adhering to the 75% core services requirement that was met, and that's because we were used to working on a very tight budget. The money that we had previously was spent on those things because we didn't have that much money, and we didn't have any state match or income. So we had to watch it very closely. We, in the past, have had a cap of $10,500 for ADAP. If we need to reinstitute that, we do. If we don't need to, then we release that cap. We also have had a cap on patient care, which we run together with our ADAP, and that's at $2,000. So we do everything we possibly can before we would have to reinstitute a waiting list. Like I said, the requirements weren't hard for us to match because we're used to running a very tight budget.
I would just add, because we've had many states over the years that have had waiting lists, and we talk to them, and I know NASDAQ talks to them all the time, to a person from the representing the program, they say what Noreen said, which is a very personal challenge for them in terms of having to implement a waiting list. And it's, I've never heard a state say it wasn't sort of the last resort for trying to figure out what to do in those situations. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I would like you to please help me thank all of our panelists. And thank you for being here. And we'll stay up for a little while if people have additional questions. This was webcast, and all of the materials, as well as webcast, will be on our site, so you can access the information. And all of us are available today and beyond today if you have other questions. Thank you again.